1500 UTC.
Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, September 7, 2023. Some internally displaced persons protest against food shortages inside a UN-run camp in Unity State.
The WFP came out and surprised the people of IDP camp that there will be no another food distribution in the IDP camp, which we don't expect to come from them, because the people who are living now in the IDP, they have stayed here for a decade.
And an analyst says autocratic governments in Africa should expect military takeovers.
As these coups are accommodated by the African Union and regional economic communities, it's opened the door for other military actors who have political ambitions to seize power. And so there's a momentum going on.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A known number of internally displaced persons sheltering at a UN-run camp in Unity State capital Bantu held a peaceful demonstration Wednesday to protest against a decision by the UN's World Food Programme to suspend food distribution. A WFP official says the agency is providing food assistance to fewer people than before due to funding shortages. Liep Nyak Jok reports for VOA from Bantu.
The IDPs blocked the entrance to UN compound in Bintu and camp nearby football field, chanting a slogan requesting WFP to cancel a decision to stop food distribution to IDPs. Some angry young men and women who participated in the demonstration say the IDPs have not received food aid since July. David Garang, who has lived at the Bintu POC camp for the first 8 years, say men of the IDPs Bintu depend on WFP food aid.
The WFP came out and surprised the people of IDP camp that there will be no another food distribution in the IDP camp, which we don't expect to come from them, because the people who are living now in the IDP, they have stayed here for a decade.
Another IDP, Nyadierom, say WFP suspended food distribution in the camp, say children are becoming weak because of the hunger, adding that many of them have stopped going to school.
We came here to show ourselves that we are suffering, and many people have died in the camp. We are saying that we shall not finish. Let the UN agency see first what is killing us, because it is hunger. We will not hide it, because it is hunger that is really killing us.
Community leaders at the camp, Solomon Yenshang, say before the July, each IDP has received 2 kilo of sorghum, half of kilo of bean, salt, and half a liter of cooking oil per month. Shang say in July, WFP in its state distribute 19,000 South Sudanese pound, an equivalent to $19 to each IDP. He say WFP official informed IDPs in July that the agency was suspending a food distribution until further note. The community leaders appeal to WFP to resume food distribution, alleging that many of the areas remain flooded and IDPs have nowhere to cultivate their own food.
We know those all challenges are there, but the context of our life or the context of our situation here in Unity State IDP camp is very dire. We have nowhere we can get an assistance.
The WFP Deputy Country Director for South Sudan, Sean Hughes, say the agency used to provide food aid to 7.8 million people across South Sudan. He say due to funding shortage, the UN agency is now helping 2.2 million people across South Sudan.
Currently in South Sudan, WFP is facing a funding gap in 2023 of over $500 million. Now that means that we need to prioritize the funding that we do receive to the areas and the timing when it's needed most.
U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Michael J. Halla announced in February this year that the Biden administration donated an additional $288 million for humanitarian assistance to the people of South Sudan. The USAID said the money will help World Food Program to address the acute humanitarian need facing 2.2 million people in South Sudan. The UN-run protection of the civilian camp in Bentiu hosts more than internally displaced persons who fled their home during the South Sudan conflict of 2013. For BOA News, I'm Liel Nyajwa in Bentiu, United States.
Sudan's Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan arrived in Doha Thursday for talks with Qatari Emir, his third trip abroad during his nearly five-month conflict with paramilitaries. The French news agency AFP says Burhan and Qatari Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad al-Thani will discuss bilateral relations, issues of common interest, and the situation in Sudan. Burhan issued a decree late on Wednesday dissolving the paramilitary rapid support forces, with whom Sudan's regular army has been at conflict since April 15. He says he based his decision on RSF forces' rebellion against the state, the grave violations they committed against citizens, and the deliberate sabotage of the country's infrastructure. The United States has imposed sanctions on Abdulrahim Hamdan Dagalo, a senior commander in the Sudan's rapid support forces and the brother of RSF commander Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, for his connection to alleged abuses by RSF against civilians in Sudan, including conflict-related sexual violence and killings based on ethnicity. For more insights, VOA's Paul Ndiho spoke with Dr. Edgar Gidua, an international relations, security, and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi.
The resolution aspect of the conflict is taking a new angle. The U.S. recently issued sanctions on the deputy leader of the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces. And from where I see it, the U.S., of course, claims that he is culpable of human rights abuses. And the truth of the matter is that both sides are culpable of human rights abuses. Now, if the U.S. does not go ahead and also issue sanctions on the senior leadership on Burhan's side, this is going to create a problem in trying to resolve this conflict, because here you have a major world power almost indirectly showing like it has chosen sides. Because to the combatants who are on the ground, they will feel that they were unfairly targeted, that one side is being unfairly targeted. In conflict resolution, we call it this heavy footprint. It's called the heavy international footprint. That heavy international footprint, they need to be very careful on how they try to intervene. So for me, it would have been better if at all the sanctions were issued on both parties and on senior leadership. The very fact that it is Dagalo's younger brother who is being targeted, that is directly targeting Dagalo. It is like firing a warning shot at Dagalo and telling him, we are coming for you next. So I have a feeling the RSF are going to dig in. The RSF are going to become hardliners. They will feel unfairly victimized, and this may complicate the resolution of the conflict in Sudan.
You raise a very interesting angle here, but looking at it from what it is, do you think maybe based on the evidence that they have, they made the right decision?
Both sides are to blame for this conflict. Both sides have committed atrocities. So it may not, I don't want to use the word fair, it may not be prudent or wise to single out one side and remove what we're calling the big stick of sanctions to work, because sometimes sanctions are not effective. Unless, in my view, you can cut off the arms supplies to Burhan and Dagalo, sanctions will only hurt the Sudanese people. I think trying to draw both parties back to the negotiating table is the wiser decision, in my view. And to try, because these forces are almost of equal power, one is more legitimate. One could claim more legitimacy than the other one, but these forces are almost equal power. And I dare say Dagalo probably even has the more superior forces in terms of armament and training. So when you start going for his side, he is going to dig himself into a trench, and he's going to now cause, it's going to endanger the whole peace process.
Earlier, you alluded to the fact that once upon a time, Al-Burhan was confined to one area he could not even leave. Yes. It looks like he's had an upper hand, the fact that he's able to do what he's supposed to do as the leader of that country. He's traveled to Egypt, he's traveled to other places. That shows that maybe he's technically in charge of that country.
Yeah, you're right. I like the way you're looking at it. There is that perception. Politics is about optics. Politics is about perception. For he needs to show up, he needs to show his forces that he is not a coward, he is not confined, he is in charge. So he has to play that card. He has to show people that he's still in charge of his country.
That's Edgar Gitua, an international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, speaking to VOA's Paul Ndiho. Still on Sudan, it has been nearly 5 months since conflict broke out in the country. The UN Refugee Agency estimates that by the end of the year, 1.8 million people will have to flee to the neighboring countries. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, Mariama Diallo, reports on a group of Sudanese artists who came together recently to deal with the trauma of conflict by showcasing their work in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Organizers called the event Resilient Transitions, an opportunity, says curator Rahim Shaddad, to create a space where all the Sudanese artists in exile can come together and meet others like themselves.
One of the main reasons why we did this event was to sort of bring in the Sudanese artists who came here, visual artists who came here due to the war, and connect them in a way or another to the artists who are already here in Nairobi, who have already created such a support system.
As a director of Downtown Gallery in Khartoum, Shaddad says it's been very difficult.
Most of us have lost a lot. Like for me, I lost the gallery, which hosts over 450 paintings inside.
Event co-organizer Mohamed El Hassan, also known as Mo, was director of 249 Arts and Culture in Sudan. He says the event is a way to introduce the artists to the local market and try to connect them to the world.
What it means for us is basically to support these artists who had to flee the war and come here and restart from scratch. They lost their galleries, they lost their studios, they lost even their ready art that was there. For me, the most significant thing, first of all, is for these artists to be able to produce again.
Abu Bakr Mawaz, also known as Bakri, left Khartoum a few months after the war started. He had to go through Ethiopia before landing in Kenya about a month ago.
It was just tough days, really, really tough days, because you need to sleep outside in the streets for maybe 4 days, waiting for your bus and waiting for visas and a lot of stuff.
Mawaz describes one painting that depicts a woman in the midst of the chaos of war. He says that through his paintings, he hopes to show the world the reality of what's happening inside Sudan.
He's sitting in here, confused, don't know what to do, and there is a gunshots around her.
Tibian Bahari is another Sudanese artist who told us the war has affected her and others in different ways.
My painting has now significantly changed in terms of strength, in terms of contributing, in terms of I am also here as well. I feel angry and I'm not rushing into navigating that emotion of anger. I'm actually dwelling into the question of what now? What can I do? How can I contribute as a diaspora?
Ibrahim Ahmad, also known as Snoopy, is an award-winning Sudanese filmmaker who, like many, was also recently displaced because of the war.
To me, I've lost almost everything, like totally everything. The only thing that I went out with was my phone. But I've lost everything because one of the reasons was that everyone thought that it will end soon because it happened in Sudan in the past, like when there was a coup or like protest in the corona.
Ahmad says he's been building his filmmaking and video production business for the past 5 years and values the loss of equipment he left behind between $40,000 to $50,000. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, do you know how many military coups happened in Africa this year? Stay tuned for an answer to that question.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Gabon's coup was the ninth in Africa since 2022 after takeovers in Guinea, Chad, Sudan, Niger, and two each in Mali and Burkina Faso. Joseph Segley, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, noted that they built on other cases of dominant military hijacking democratic movements to retain ultimate authority in Egypt, Zimbabwe, Algeria, and Burundi. He explained to VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi what is driving the rise in military coups in Africa.
There's a variety of factors at play here. The tolerance we've seen for the earlier coups, and as these coups are accommodated by the African Union and regional economic communities, it's opened the door for other military actors who have political ambitions to seize power. And so there's a momentum going on. Second, I would say, is that it's an outgrowth of growing politicization we've seen of militaries over recent years, where some political actors within Africa will politicize militaries as a means of ensuring their own regime survival. But in the process of politicizing the military, it creates incentives for those close to power to see that with an additional step on their part, they themselves can gain power. And thereby, instead of just being close to power, they themselves are the power. I think what we're seeing also reflects the long legacy of military government in Africa, and particularly in the countries where we've seen the coups. And within these militaries, there is a persistent sense of entitlement to govern, where they haven't fully accepted the notion that democratically elected civilians have the only genuinely legitimate authority to govern. And instead, they see themselves as being a rightful authority to govern their states. And so we're seeing this resurgence in mentality among different African militaries. And a very clear example of this was vividly displayed when we saw the Niger coup, and immediately when ECOWAS was threatening that they would intervene to help restore the democratically elected president, that you saw the military juntas in Mali and Burkina Faso rise up in defense of the junta in Niger. And so what we're seeing is this coalition of military juntas now defending the rights of military juntas to govern in Africa. So it's a very direct affront to civilian democratic government in Africa.
You also indicated that there are also cases where elected leaders undermine democratic checks and balances in office to consolidate power and prolong their tenures, such as Tunisia's Otoku. But let me note that the African Union membership includes leaders who are either undemocratic or masters of manipulating the constitution to extend their term limits. How could the African Union be influential in countering the tide of military coups in Africa?
There have been some 13 different African leaders who evaded term limits in the last several years. And with fewer African leaders really being committed to and in power because of their democratic credentials, it weakens the ability of regional bodies to step in. Nonetheless, I believe that the regional actors must play an essential role in reversing this tide of coups. Otherwise, we're likely to see many more coups on the continent. And they can do this in a number of ways. And one is to just be very clear that you're not going to recognize the coups when they occur. And there's an important historical point here, an evolution between what the Organization of African Unity versus the African Union was all about. Between 1960 and 2000, there were 82 coups in Africa. And as part of the founding of the African Union, there was a concerted effort to move past the OAU's policy of non-interference to one of calling out coups and moving to a policy of non-indifference. And between 2000 and about 2020, we saw a dramatic decline in the number of coups on the continent. And in fact, they adopted the African Charter on Democracy, which stipulates that any member state who endures an extra constitutional seizure of power, you know, should lose their membership as part of the African Union. And it authorizes other penalties against those mounting coups. And so I think what we're seeing today is a real challenge to the regional bodies to see just how committed they are to these principles and then to persist in trying to ensure that there are costs on those who are engaging in them.
That's Joseph Stegley, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, based here in Washington. He was speaking to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. The mandate of the East African Force that was deployed in the Democratic Republic of Congo has been extended until December. The announcement came as regional leaders met in Nairobi to assess the status of the security in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Moses Habyarimana reports.
During the 22nd Extraordinary Summit of the East African Community Heads of State that took place on Tuesday in Nairobi, the leaders of the East African Community countries indicated that the mandate of the regional forces needs to be extended to restore peace and stability in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Dr. Peter Matuki is the Secretary General of the East African Community.
The summit noted that the current mandate of the regional force will be expiring on 8th September 2023. Therefore, the heads of state agreed to extend duration of the mandate of the East African Community Regional Force and the Status of Forces Agreement for a further period of 3 months.
The extension of the mandate comes at a time when more than 40 people were killed last week in anti-UN protests in the eastern city of Goma that demanded the withdrawal of UN and regional peacekeepers. The bandy protesters accused MONUSCO peacekeepers of failing to protect civilians against decades of attacks by rebel group in the eastern part of the country. Fred Mukasambide is an EAC integration expert and vice president of the Democratic Party in Uganda.
The extension of the Status of Forces Agreement and generally the stay of the standard force in the EAC, the president of the DRC needs to accompany such presence of forces with the necessary goodwill to perform the objects for which they were placed there. The disadvantage that may exist is where President Tshisekedi begins to think that the forces are there for purposes of fighting the M23, because then that would have created a dichotomy between his own population.
The deployment of the regional forces met with mixed reactions by the citizens and the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo, as President Felix Tshisekedi early this year openly criticized the regional forces of not executing their mandate. The move led to the resignation of Regional Force Commander General Jeff Nyanga from duty after being criticized by Kinshasa for failing to rein the M23 group behind the attacks in the eastern DRC. When reached, DRC's communication minister and government spokesperson Patrick Muyaya said he was not able to comment on the renewal of the East African Forces mandate. The EAC chairman of the Heads of State Summit, President Evariste Ndayishimiye, last month visited Kinshasa and signed a bilateral defense pact with President Felix Tshisekedi. During his visit, President Evariste Ndayishimiye said that the mission of the regional force is to return peace to the DRC while fighting against the foreign forces. According to the UN, violence in Congo has caused one of the world's worst and longest-running humanitarian emergencies, with more than 27 million people facing food shortages and nearly 5.5 million forced to flee their homes. For Voice of America, I'm Moses Havyarimana.
U.S. lawmakers face a long list of priorities as they return to work this week after their month-long August recess, with battles looming over U.S. aid to Ukraine and a possible impeachment of President Joe Biden. The top concern remains funding the U.S. government to keep it from shutting down on October 1st. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
With just 10 working days left until funding for the U.S. government runs out on September 30th, there is almost no chance the Republican majority House and Democratic majority U.S. Senate can agree on a full year of funding in time. Chuck Schumer is the Senate majority leader.
Time is short. And the only way to avoid a shutdown is through bipartisanship in both the House and the Senate. House Republicans have their first chance to show their commitment to bipartisanship when they return next week.
Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy faces criticism from conservative members of his party for cutting a deal earlier this year to avoid the U.S. hitting its debt ceiling. He argues a short-term spending bill keeping the government open will allow Republicans more time to negotiate spending levels. Michael Thorning is director of structural democracy at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
They're really having some tough negotiations and debates just within their own party. And so that's really where the sticking point is. And I don't know that it's any sign of long-term dysfunction. I think it's really just actually a function of a very slim majority in the House.
U.S. lawmakers will also debate $40 billion in supplemental funding priorities unveiled by the Biden administration over the summer recess, including $21 billion in military and humanitarian aid for Ukraine. Some conservatives are threatening to block that aid. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy.
I'm certainly worried that Republicans in the House seem to be getting cold feet when it comes to supporting Ukraine. This is the worst possible time to suggest that there is any division in the United States over continuing to support Ukraine, just as they are making progress.
A major supporter of USAID to Ukraine, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is closely watched as he returns to work after a second episode of freezing up over the summer recess. McConnell downplayed concerns about his health Tuesday. Mitch McConnell is the Senate Minority Leader.
One particular moment of my time back home has received its fair share of attention in the press over the past week. But I assure you, August was a busy and productive month for me.
The U.S. Senate physician said there is no evidence that a stroke or seizure caused McConnell's episodes. Most Senate Republicans say they are still confident in his ability to lead. Republican Senator Mitt Romney.
I don't know that anyone has a responsibility to lay out all of their medical documents, but we do look at the leader and how he's able to manage our caucus. And it's very clear he's been able to raise the money, get people elected, direct us on important policy issues.
U.S. lawmakers will also debate the massive annual national defense authorization after clashing over competing versions of the $886 billion legislation earlier this summer. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
And that's all we prepared for you this Thursday, September 7, 2023. We now leave you with Rhymus and the song Children of the Soil.
Our people, while we're still shooting and chopping with pangas for no reason, shall we ever stop the blood flowing?
I'm your host, John Tanza, and on behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
In order to repay the damages, we are the children of the soil. We are fraternity and liberty. In order to repair the damages, we are the children of the soil. I taught me fought like a team. We civilians get the support. North East lives without water. Civilians are like a water body. A nation to develop, not a single fashion, tribe, or region for paternity. We need to struggle as a team. People remember we suffered. Unite to heal their wounds. In order to repair the damages, we are fighting for equality, fraternity,